Good morning. It is March 12th, and this is the Education Subcommittee on Education. I hear tell everybody wants to know when we're going to pass the budget, and what I would say is be patient. This morning, we have a public hearing on House Bill 5016 and hearing on House Bill 5017. And Doug, good for the order. Which page are we on? And
I believe we're starting on page 150. I think that's page 150, probably, or 151. And my anticipation is that we'll finish up Monday with their presentation, and then there will be another day of public hearing on Tuesday. And then the hope and the prayer is that we start with the Higher Education Committee Coordinating Commission on Wednesday. That is our anticipated schedule as of now. And again, I apologize for the mix-up. It doesn't sound like we were the only subcommittee that had notices sent out about the wrong date and the meeting being canceled. So we're looking to see what happened to the system on that.
And if it's the system or the Senate, we don't worry about it. Okay. And anything else for the good of the order? Good morning, Senator Roblin. We're so happy to see you. And for the people that are in the audience today, if you weren't here for the past 2 days, the testimony was just amazing, and I know that many of us felt like, oh, there's so many needs. And then when they bring the children up to the dais, it's like, it's all over. We just kind of want to put everything into, what's that, EI?
EI, Early Intervention and Early Childhood Special Ed.
Yeah, it's not EI, EIO, so. Any other comments from the committee before we start?
Every panel was more compelling than the last.
Yeah.
Really, and the range, too.
Yes. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It did highlight the need for us to have Mr. Wilson's list about, you know, because there were a lot of, there's a lot of testimony on different pots of money. From relief nurseries to whatever, and so knowing where that money's going to be asked out of will be handy.
And be patient.
Madam Chair, Representative Hoffman, the plan is to go through that on Monday.
Isn't that nice?
He's awesome.
I know, but you nag.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Drip. Okay.
Stop. He's like a second grader.
I've been told that.
Okay. Mr. Saxon, we'll get on with the play here. It's going to turn into a Shakespearean tragedy very quickly. So,
Chair Comp, members of the committee, Rob Saxon, Deputy Superintendent. It's good to be here today, a little smaller room. And, the testimony for the last couple of days was really compelling. And I started early in my presentation talking about the breadth of what it is that we try to do at the Department of Education, and that was a really good sample of some of the different parts of the work that we have underway. So, good stuff. You had a couple questions from the last day that we met, and I wanted to answer those questions. One of those was how many students are in preschools run by school districts in the state, and we don't have a very definitive answer to that. We collected some data this last year as we tried to get our data about full-day kindergarten wrapped up. The hard part with this is that we don't know how many students districts are actually serving. We've not ever collected that information. So these are all the districts that have at least some preschool that they're offering, but I think that universal preschool is very rare among school districts unless they're real small or incredibly poor, perhaps.
Definition of universal?
Universal being that it's offered to all four-year-olds who live in a community.
Thank you.
I think that there are, in most of these districts, what you would find is where they have multiple schools, there might be one school where they offer preschool, but not all. And so the actual number of this is really hard to determine. We thought about, well, we could, you know, do a calculation, but of how many students attend these and make some educated guesses, but I don't really think that we can. We can just say that these are the school districts that offer them. And then The second question was around how much funding do the early learning early learning hubs have compared to the former State Commission of Children and Families. And in 13-15, the early learning hubs had $4.3 million to coordinate. And in 11-13, the county commissions had $9.6 million. So they had $5.3 million more than did the hubs. So there is a difference there. And then in addition, in 11-13, the local commissions had $1.5 million in Great Start funding compared to 13-15 when the hubs had $513,000. And in 11-13, the hubs, and I'll get it right here in a minute, the local commissions received $1.9 million in title for B2 family supporting funds, and the hubs received $1.1 million. $1.8 million for that.
Definition of, or what is a Great Start funding?
Co-Chair Comp, I do not have that information. I'm sure that my
that's fine.
Early learning compatriots could answer that question.
Okay. So I feel better now knowing you don't know either.
Okay. So
let's hit it.
And I apologize for that. We have two, but we'll have that answer for you tomorrow. I have a couple of slides.
Well, we probably won't be here in this committee tomorrow.
Oh, that's true. Monday.
Okay.
We have a couple of slides here before we hit state school funds, so I just wanted to touch on these quickly. I believe I showed these previously to both House and Senate Ed. But in addition to the Early Learning Division and Youth Development Division programs, we have a number of other responsibilities around state and federal education programs. And so you see here the state school fund, Common School Fund, then Early Learning, Youth Development, Debt Service, Operations, Youth Correction, School for the Deaf, and Grant and Aid. So those are all different components of the work that we do. And this is just a similar recitation of that, but basically the programs and services on the left, and then the target group for those programs and services on the right. And again, a continuation of some of those things with the programs and services in the target group.
Mr. Saxton, I have a question. We've been talking about summer school programs or extended day programs. Do we get any federal funding for those programs at this time, or is it all out of the general fund?
Co-chairs Comp and Moreau, members of the committee. I'll have to get back to you with to be 100% accurate on that question. I believe that there are some federal funds that we get to run some summer programs, mm-hmm. but they come with some specific kinds of requirements. And that, so for example, you can use Title I funds to extend school time, and a district could choose to use those to offer summer school, but it isn't specifically necessarily targeted for that. Districts have lots of choice about how they decide to do that, and there are other similar kinds of funds like that. I could come back with a more complete list.
Okay.
But in general,
And if some of those ties are, I think, possibly that's to some of the, free lunch programs and such, because we do have a couple of bills out there wanting to add to that summer school or just the full year-round school to make sure the reduced lunch students also have that opportunity.
Yes, Co-Chair Comp, that's correct, that there are summer feeding programs that school districts are able to offer quite broadly that we receive some federal monies to offer.
Yeah. Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do believe that for special groups like students with disabilities and others, there are summer programs that are directly funded by some of that federal money. But it's a select clientele for a select reason, is my understanding.
Co-Chair Comp, Senator Roblin, that also is correct, that there are programs for students who show that they would suffer significant regression over the course of the summer, where we receive federal funds to offer special education programs specifically for those students.
Thank you.
your cue.
This is a drum roll for you now, Brian.
If I can get this microphone in a good place, is that working?
Yes.
Okay. Co-chairs Monroe and Comp, Brian Reeder, assistant superintendent in the research office at the Department of Education. I'm going to walk you through the basics of Oregon's school funding formula today, talk a little bit about some proposed tweaks to the formula, but primarily to give you an idea how the formula works and some of the details of the formula itself.
And Brian, are you comfortable with members asking questions as we go?
Co-chair Comp, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Just jump in wherever you like. So this is a slide that actually is quite similar to the one that we showed you just a moment ago that shows the distribution of ODE's resources, and you can see the bulk of our budget is the state school fund, and that flows through, every bit of that flows through the department out to school districts and ESTs. You can see that the state school fund is really made up of two primary pieces, the general fund, the lion's share of the state school fund, about 95%, just under 5% comes from lottery funds, and then there, of course, is always, in every aspect of budgeting, there's a little category called other that nobody knows what's in it, and I don't know what's in it. It's a tenth of 1%, and actually the legislation simply says miscellaneous other funds, so our budget or our accounting folks could probably tell us what that is, but I personally do not know. Maybe those parties we have on Fridays.
Be cautious. Your boss is sitting next to you.
Just opened up line of questioning, Madam Chair.
Okay, so the prior slide you saw was last biennium, 13-15. Right. This is the same slide for the current service level of funding for 15-17. And it looks pretty much identical. 5% from the lottery, 95% from the general fund, which is, as you know, personal and corporate income taxes are the source of those funds. State school fund, as we just saw, is the largest of ODE's programs. The formula itself distributes both state school fund dollars and local dollars. It takes those into account when it determines how much money each school district will get, and then the amount that school districts don't have in their hands already as local funds, we pay them from the state school fund.
Yes, Representative Huffman.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Brian, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to think about this slide until you go back to the last one and I ask a couple of questions to get things solid in my mind, just to make sure, because I'm new on this subcommittee, so forgive me. So I want to make sure I'm comparing the right numbers. The general fund, $6.445 billion, would compare with the governor's proposed 6.9 something or other. Is that right? Or would we be comparing the 6.77 to the governor's 6.9 something?
Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Representative Huffman, it would be to the 6.77 would be the comparable number.
Okay. So 6.77, and we heard testimony a couple of days ago from K-12 folks that they have to have 7.5 just for cost of service roll-up. So we're going from 6.777 to 7.5 in their numbers just to keep them whole. Okay, just trying to keep it clear. That's a pretty substantial needs increase. You have an answer?
Well, I'm sorry I walked out, but you're asking why the difference, I think.
Yes.
If Mr. Reeder wants to take a stab where I can.
Co-chairs Compton, Monroe, Representative Huffman. This number here is an estimate of the current service level, which is how much money will it take in 15-17 for school districts to provide the same level of services that they provided in 13-15. And maybe Doug can help me on this. Does the 6.77 include full day kindergarten?
There are two different CSL estimates, the LFO and the executive branches. The difference is LFO's includes the amount for full day kindergarten. And it also includes the roll up for the $100 million that was added in 2014 session for the second year of the current school year, really. So those things roll up to a significantly greater amount than the amount that you see here. So this is the executive branch's current service levels. Ours are different. And then on top of that, the districts are really looking at their cost structure, not necessarily our definition of CSL. We work off of what the state provided to districts in the previous biennium. They're looking at what they think their costs are into the future, and those are two different bases.
I'm pretty sure I know what your answer is going to be, but the LFO estimate.
Representative Huffman.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes, thank you.
Or maybe an additional. I'm not sure how it's going to turn
out. Well, as long as it gets put in the record.
So LFO's estimate, is that reflected in the co-chair's 7.235, or are those different numbers also?
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, those are slightly different numbers. I mean, we talked to them about our CSL, and those things are generally factored into it, but they do come up with a different, I mean, they come up with the number they think they need to put into their framework for those purposes.
Follow-up comment, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Huffman.
Okay, I'm just, again, trying to grasp the numbers, and I think it's really interesting when the department comes in at 6777 that doesn't include full-day kindergarten, which is in statute. I'm not sure why we would look at a number that doesn't include something that's mandated. And then school districts include all costs, but we're telling school districts, well, but we're going to ignore some of the costs that you figure you have to spend. And they're going, but how do you ignore those costs? Because we have to write a check. So as a new member, that's kind of where I am. Thanks.
Mr. Reeder.
Kutcher Comp, Representative Huffman, I'll point out, first of all, that this current service level number is not a Department of Education number. This is a number arrived at by the Revenue Forecast Committee, which is run by the Department of Administrative Services. We have input into this, but we do not determine the rules by which this is calculated. So this is not our number to start with.
Yes, and then we have a few
thank
more
you.
Questions, but
thank
this,
you,
is,
Madam
this is
Chair.
Important
so,
information.
So I should have, and thank you, Brian. I appreciate that differentiation. So I should have said, how does DAS come up with a number like this? Yeah. Just to clarify.
Well, did you know that DAS created the number? So then
that's why I said thank you, Brian.
Rob, now I know Senator Roblin has some input too. Is that okay if we go first?
It's just a quick question. And basically, this does not include the local contributions to schools, the property tax on that, correct? Or it does? Does not?
Co-chair Comp, Senator Roblin, it is not. This is just state money.
Okay. So do we ever get that information about the total amount that is going to equalize and everything so that we know what the total cost of that is going to be?
Co-chair Comp, Senator Roblin, we will get to that shortly.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Co-chair Monroe, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Sorry I was late. I was testifying on another bill. Current service level plus full-day kindergarten would get us to about the 7.2 that the co-chairs are recommending.
I think that's your question.
Yeah.
I can it's probably more. Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, it is close to that number. The LFO current service level, and I have to go run back to my office and get the right amount, but it's close to what the co-chairs are. But keep in mind, the current services level is one item of input that the co-chairs have and they use in coming up with their number. It doesn't necessarily automatically take that. They look at other parts of the budget, and I can tell you their desire was to put as much as they felt they could afford into that number at this at the point they were putting their framework together.
And Madam,
yes,
and,
Mr. Co-chair.
Madam Co-chair, and yet we had several district leaders coming in and telling us that if they don't get 7.5, they will be making cuts. So if 7.24 funds current service level, seems like they ought to be able to provide current service level on that amount of money. And why do they say they need 7.5 and that that won't be an increase, but it'll just be a hold steady of where they are now? That's what I heard them say. And can somebody answer that?
Co-chairs Kaufman and Monroe, members of the committee, I probably can shed a little bit of light on the concern there. I don't want to enter into the current service level. I'm trying to talk myself out of entering into the current service level discussion and just making it muddier, but so I'll stay out of that. What I would say about having budgeted as a superintendent in a local school district is that there really is a disconnect that exists between current service level, state school fund budget, and the realities of a local school district. And it simply is the local school district is an independent piece of government that creates its own economy, basically, or its own requirements for dollars based on all kinds of decisions, and that really every district is in a different place. Part of that is because every district has a different contract with their employment groups, and that probably makes up roughly 85% of their budget, and so that really is an important consideration. Most districts have a really different situation now with PERS, and there's a huge impact on PERS because some districts bonded to pay off some of their PERS debt as early as 2001, 2002, because they could borrow money more cheaply on the bond market, pay that debt off, and that it creates a savings gap because the rate that PERS charges is higher than what they're actually paying for the bond dollars that they borrowed, assuming that they were able to make good investments in the bond dollars that they borrowed. For some districts who borrowed in 2007 or maybe 2006, right before the market went down, they actually are paying more for PERS than they would have had they just stayed with PERS. And so there are all kinds of vagaries that are taking place across districts that have them all in different places. There probably are districts in the state that honest and truly, you know, need much less than 7.5 in order to not have to make any reductions this coming year. It depends on all of the factors and many more than those that I just elaborated on, what their transportation situation looks like, what they've decided to do around buildings and bonds. If you've been able to pass bonds and you have brand new buildings everywhere, your maintenance cost structure and your energy costs ought to be much lower. Or if you have been able to keep the cost of your employees who get injured and so forth, keep that rate down, and your factor is down on that. That creates a different kind of cost saving. So there are all kinds of things out there. Are districts offering full day K, and is it for free, or are they offering preschool or not, that enter into how much does it cost for us to operate next year as it does this year? And so the truth of the matter is that there is a very significant disconnect about how districts decide to use monies, and so whether or not they're going to need to cut or not cut. There probably are districts that will cut at 7.8, and there probably are districts that would not cut at 7.2 or 7.1. It's all over the board, and part of that is depending on the program that they've chosen and the financial moves that they've made.
And that's why we have local control.
Yeah. Yes.
Senator Monroe.
Well, the reason I ask this is because this subcommittee has to make a very critical balancing choice. We want to fund true current service level. We want to fund full day kindergarten, but we also want to fund some of the early childhood programs that we had heard so much testimony on over the last 2 days, and you know, balancing where the scarce dollars go is going to be our job in the next few weeks. And so having good numbers, you know, what is really a true current service level cost plus kindergarten and so on. And so we're going to need to conclude that, and this subcommittee's job to figure that out. And I haven't got it all figured out. I'm meeting with the governor's staff later today, and we're going to be talking about these things, and I'll be trying to get input from the new governor and you know, where she's coming down. I have a pretty good idea. And then, you know, we're going to be going to work, and whatever decision we come up with, there will be people that are unhappy about it. I guarantee you.
Lots of people.
So, thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Yes. Do you have a question, Rep. Taylor?
Yes, please.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Co-Chair Comp. So I wanted to understand, though, it's based on everything that you just said, and I appreciate the description about when it gets down to the district level, and some could very well be better off than others. So how do we, maybe it's a question for the committee members, how do we avoid, with the grant and aid and with some of the ways that these more special requests are and how they're going to be distributed, some will qualify for those services more than others, and it seems that we're running the risk of some districts, the intended or unintended consequence is that some could be considerably better off than others with this change in how we're distributing these extra sums of money. Is that, maybe Doug can answer? Yes, for the strategic investments and the grant and aid. And
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, first of all, the grant and aids, many of them go out on a formula basis or the number of special population groups to the districts directly. They do not flow through the state school fund. Strategic investments, which really in the scheme of things do not add up to a great deal of money compared to the state school fund, go out, many of them as grants and RFP, responses to RFPs. They all, but that's all separate from the state school fund.
Right.
And it's a matter of, you know, the state school fund number is set, is usually set at least initially early in session, and that's the decision that drives a heck of a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if I answered your questions or not.
Follow up?
Not trying to skirt it.
Please, Representative.
Thank you, Co-Chair Comp. I, too, am new, and so thank you, Doug. I understand that it doesn't flow through the state school fund. I'm just wanted to say on the record that we're in making these decisions that we're setting, we're going down a path, it sounds like, of some districts could be, we're building a foundation for them to have some programs and some activities going. And I'm sure they're all in need of them, but what I don't want is the folks who need the services the most are the ones who aren't getting it because they're not sophisticated enough or something, or whatever the reason is, and that the consequence is that those that are more sophisticated are the winners. So I just wanted to share that.
Yes, thank you. And I want one other point, Brian. If you would explain the transportation grant funding and how the ESDs fit into this picture.
Oh boy.
So that, I'm not going to go off on a big tangent here. I just want all members to understand that out of that 7.3, all that's not going to go directly to the school districts. Am I right or wrong?
Representative Comp, that's exactly right. Some of that will go to ESDs. Right now, under law, 95.5% of the total dollars in the system, both state money and local money, of districts and ESDs, essentially it's all put into one pot, and 95.5% goes to school districts, and 4.5% goes to ESDs.
Yep. And then the reimbursement for transportation comes out of the other. I mean, it's taken out later or as presented from the previous biennium.
Co-Chair Comp, That's correct. It's a reimbursement. It's one of the few true reimbursements that we have in our formula, and it goes only to school districts, not to ESDs, and it in essence comes off the top before the distribution through the regular formula occurs. Because it's a reimbursement, the amount is based on actual spending of school districts, so that needs to come off and be paid prior to the distribution through the formula itself.
And the only last question I have about transportation is that in talking with the deputy superintendent, if we have summer school programs, I'm wondering in my mind, will some school districts, as Representative Taylor referred to, will they have federal title fund dollars to help pay for their transportation, or will we as a state be transporting our students at part of our current service level?
Representative Comp, I don't think I can give you a complete answer to that right now, but I'll find out. Under the law regarding our transportation reimbursement, we define what we call qualifying costs. So not all costs, transportation costs, are qualify for being reimbursed. So athletic trips do not qualify. They have to be related either to home to school, school to home, or educationally related, like a field trip for educational purposes. I don't know whether it specifically says transportation for summer school programs,
extended school day,
and qualify or don't qualify. I will have to check on that.
Thank you. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Rob, thanks for your explanation on the difference between school districts. That was helpful for me. I just want to make the point that if this body's going to mandate full-day kindergarten for schools.
Have.
I know. I was here. I was one of the only no votes because the bill did not have a funding mechanism built into it. I was told that the money would be there when the time came. So I want to hold our feet to the fire that the money is there for the school districts now that the time has come. And I look down here, and I would encourage all the members to look at what Rob came in, because this is one of my concerns. We dropped the Commission on Children and Families with the promise that the money's going to be there for the change in early learning, and thus far it has not been. And so that's why I point these things out. Thank you.
Well, and I appreciate your due diligence, Representative. And again, it's what Co-Chair Monroe and I encourage all of us to keep a list of these questions or when we get to decision-making time, we need to think about these different pieces. So, Mr. Reeder, let's hit it.
Thank you. I guess we're at bullet number two here. We need to keep in mind that the revenue that districts get through the formula is not all the revenue they have. It's about 80% of the revenue. They also have federal dollars. They have state grants for specific purposes that don't go through the formula. They have their own local option levies if they have passed them. So when we're talking about this is just on the operating side, the formula amount is about 80% of the total operating revenue that they have. The formula itself, is in statute. It's once you get all the data defined and in place, the formula itself is fairly straightforward. And it really has a couple purposes. To equalize funding across districts in the state, if you go back to the time prior to the formula, we had in Oregon a quite large variation in the amount of funding per student around the state, depending on local property wealth and willingness of voters to pass levies and so forth. Under the formula, we equalize funding on a weighted student basis, and we'll talk a little bit more about what a weighted student is, but we try to provide additional, or the formula does, provide additional funding to districts that have students with higher needs, and the formula defines those as special education students, limited English proficient students, students in poverty, and a couple of other categories. So the philosophy behind our formula is give added weights for districts with students who have higher costs, and then equalize funding per weight.
I thought Senator Roblin raised his hand. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Co-Chair Kopp. Just for clarification, though, in those weights, when the money is actually given to the districts, do they, if you could please explain, do the districts need to spend the money on the way that the weight has been distributed, or are the districts allowed some leeway in how they spend those funds?
Co-Chair Kopp, Representative Taylor, currently there are virtually no restrictions in law on how districts spend that money.
Thank you.
Except for you as a, you know, as a legislator can attend those board meetings. I think she's done that a few times.
And I think...
Co-Chair?
Yes, Senator Monroe.
Yeah, but before I was here, before 1990 when Measure 5 passed, and before Measure 5 passed, we were closing school districts if they couldn't pass a budget. They were actually shutting down. And so one of the things I did when I chaired the Senate Revenue Committee in the 80s was I sponsored something called the School Safety Net. Mm-hmm. And it was very controversial because it had no growth factor in it, because that was the only way I could get the voters to approve it. But it guaranteed a school district that if they couldn't pass a bond, they got the same amount of money, actual dollars, that they had the previous year. So they could at least have their doors open, even though, however inflation was, they were still going to have to make some cuts. But it was a really disastrous situation. Then Measure 5 came along, and Measure 5 said, basically equalized the amount of money that districts were going to get, and said that the state would replace the amount of money that was cut under Measure 5, but it didn't require the state to continue the funding prior to that, the state funding. It just required them to replace the property taxes that were cut. And so essentially state support for schools has declined after Measure 5 over the last 25 years, however long that is.
Thank you, Senator.
And sorry about that.
No, and I know that there are many schools that were able to keep their doors open under the safety nets. So I appreciate it. Doug, you're going to tell us how many slides we have to go?
Madam Chair, I was just going to do a reality check. You're over halfway through the meeting, and you've done 8 slides.
Well, but it's been important information. Sometimes you have to focus on the basics before we can get to the other stuff. Okay, I'm not going to talk anymore. Brian, it's all yours.
Okay, thank you, Co-Chair Kopp. I'll try to go through these quickly. They are really about the mechanics of the formula. ODE staff runs the formula. We calculate how much each school district is entitled to through the formula. We then determine how much their local revenue is, and we send them a check, essentially an electronic check for the difference. About 95% of the formula money goes out on a weighted student basis. The other 5% are things like the transportation grant and other things that are not student-based but some other basis. We talked about the share for districts and ESDs. One other point is that prior to Measure 5, about 2/3 of funding came from local money and 1/3 from state money, and leaving out the federal money for now. And today that's reversed. About 2/3 comes from the state and 1/3 from locals, and that's a direct effect of the two property tax limitations that we passed in Oregon. So here's a graph that shows you the trends over time. Formula revenue from the two sources, state and local, and you can see that switch back in the early 90s as Measure 5 phased in and local property taxes declined, and at the same time state revenue grew in response to that. You can see that local revenue has been remarkably stable since then. That's due primarily to Measure 50, not to Measure 5. Measure 50 put in place the 3% assessed value growth limitation, which makes property taxes for individual owners quite predictable and stable. And you can see that state revenue has been more volatile because it comes from income taxes. You can clearly see the recession in the early 2000s, the growth in the bubble in the mid-2000s, and then the recession in the late 2000s. So here's the shares of state and local revenue as I just described. At the local level, revenue is dominated by the property tax. There are a couple of other sources, and keep in mind that when I say local here, it's local as defined by the formula. Some of those dollars actually originate from the state and from the federal government. Federal forest fees is an example, state timber and common school fund. Those dollars originate with the state, but they are distributed to school districts prior to the formula, to our funding formula working. So they are considered local revenue in the formula.
Madam Chair.
Oh, yes, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to clarify, because I looked and it looks like you're about to move on to demographics. After the division of the state school fund and it is allocated to the districts, this I just want to clarify what I understand, which is that so even if a district has an additional local option or something, that amount just comes out of what they get from the state. It does not actually allow them to increase, have more significantly because of that balance between the state and the local funding. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Comp, Representative Smith-Warner, the example you gave, the local option levy, that is not correct.
Oh.
Local option money all stays locally. It's not labeled as local revenue in the formula. So if Portland, for example, has a local option levy, all of that money that they generate from that levy stays locally in the Portland School District.
And their state share is not reduced by that?
That's correct.
That's the only one.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. And
Madam Co-Chair, that's a critical point. Because what that means is that property wealthy districts don't get any more out of the formula, but they find that it's much easier to get a local option passed because it's less burden on each homeowner than in property poor districts, which find it very difficult to pass a local option. But the local option, if you pass it, is in addition to the statewide formula money that you get.
Thank you.
Senator Rowland.
Yeah, and just a very weird anomaly. There are a few districts, I don't know what it is now, it used to be a few more, that get no money from the state at all.
Yeah, Connie.
Yeah.
And Representative Huffman had a quick question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious where lottery funds play in. I see at the top this says property taxes, but I saw a couple of things there that I wasn't sure how they related to property taxes, but that's immaterial. So are you going to have a slide that shows input from lottery or?
Previous
slide. Elliott Forest, is that one of the state timber?
Co-Chair Comfort, Representative Huffman, yes, Elliott Forest is part of the state timber. The lottery comes in as state money that flows into the state school fund. So it's state revenue, not local revenue.
Actually, common school fund.
Yeah, I see. LA is part of the common school fund. The areas in Tillamook County and in that area, that are state-owned timber, the revenue from the sales of that timber are the state timber revenues.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Approximately how many lottery dollars, either a dollar amount or a percentage, are in that pot?
None here.
Co-Chair Comp Representative Springer, the prior slide I think showed it at about 5%.
Yep.
About 325, $27 million.
Yeah, it's about, of all the state money, the portion of the state school fund is, there it is right there.
Okay, got it.
Just one final point that to Representative Smith-Warner is that the local option taxes are really the only local revenue that don't get included, and so that don't end up offsetting state money in the formula.
There,
Senator Roblin.
There are some others, and individual districts may get some because they have agreements with corporations or others in their districts that pass money directly to the district and do not go through the state school fund or are balanced with this. Just, there are a few of those.
Mm-hmm. So demographics, we've got about 570,000 students in the K-12 system in Oregon. Historically, it has grown at about a half a percentage point per year, but we've seen a certain amount of variation. The last 5 or 6 years during the recession period, that fell down to zero, basically. We didn't have much growth at all. This last year, we went back up to about a half a percentage point.
And with the addition of all-day kinder, that's not calculated into this because that's from 2012. Okay.
Co-chair Comp, we're just counting bodies here, so those kids are already counted. They're just going to school half-day currently.
Got it.
Over the last 25 years, the two populations that have grown quite rapidly are English language learners and special ed students. We have seen a flattening out in percentage terms of English language learners, but from about 1990 to today, they grew from about 10,000 students to about 70,000 students in the state, so very rapid growth. About half of our students qualify for free and reduced price lunches under the federal program. That's one of our key measures of economic disadvantage. It's not a perfect measure, but it's really the only one we have that gets at, on an annual basis, the status of students in our schools. And the share of students of color in the system has grown quite rapidly as well over the past decade from about 21% to 35%.
And is it appropriate or inappropriate to correlate the students that qualify for free and reduced lunch, that they are potentially receiving some form of federal support in different title programs? Is that an appropriate correlation or not?
Co-chair Comp, yes, the federal title programs direct their resources primarily to students in need, and one of those categories, probably the largest of those categories, is students living in poverty.
Thank you. Senator Roman.
Yeah, just a clarification on the timber money that came in. Part of that is the ONC money that is distributed back to the state for the ONC counties, but then that money is put into the distribution formula, so that's part of the timber money. So individual districts don't gain from being an ONC county. The state gains from the ONC, and that's part of that timber money. Is that not true?
Co-chair Comp, Senator Roman, that is true. It comes to the state. It's then distributed to districts. But any money that districts get that become part of the formula, in essence, benefit all
Everybody.
Districts. They get distributed throughout the state.
Thank you.
So here's some little detail on the formula itself. The definition of weighted students that I spoke of earlier. We give weights to students based on particular characteristics, so special education students get an additional full weight, so they get a weight for being a student and they get another weight for being a special ed student, so two weights for special ed, an extra half weight for students served by English as a second language programs, an extra full weight for students in pregnant and parenting programs. And I'll point out that districts have to offer programs, those programs, to those students if they're to get the extra weight. Extra quarter weight for students in poverty. And in this measure of poverty, it's based on census data, not based on the free and reduced lunch counts in current law. quarter weights for foster care students and students defined as neglected and delinquent by the Department of Human Services.
Does that include homeless in that last category?
Co-chair Kump, I do not believe it includes homeless, but I'm not certain. I'll have to check on that.
That's all right. I don't want to know homeless numbers, then I get depressed.
Some homeless qualify.
Okay.
But for this reason.
This graph shows the effect of adding weights in the formula. So the bottom blue line is what we call average daily membership, and the R stands for resident. We count those students by the resident district that they live in. And average daily membership is a daily average number of students enrolled in Oregon schools. And it's currently at about 540,000 students. And when you add the weights, that increases it 23% up to in the neighborhood of 670,000 weights. So it's those weights that are the focus of the formula. We fund weights. We don't strictly fund students. We fund weights, but students and their characteristics determine the weights. Okay, so there's a number of different ways to look at sort of funding per student, and typically for formula purposes we look at funding per weighted student, but sometimes we also look at it per ADMR, per actual student. So this is a history of that, and you can see that it's grown over time since the early 90s. You can see the dips in the recession years, and it's currently about $9,500 per actual student in the state. If you look at it per weighted student, and these are the numbers that we typically talk about when we talk about the formula, it's risen from just over 4,000 in 1990-91 to about 7,500, 7,600 today.
Co-chair?
Yes, Senator Monroe.
During that same spread of time, what is the inflation factor? I mean, how much total inflation has there been? I'm just trying to see if we keep up with inflation or not.
Co-Chair Monroe, here's an inflation-adjusted look.
That's what I needed.
Numbers. And this is the graph that I think is the most important, because if you're talking about dollars over time and you don't adjust for inflation, then you're not getting an accurate picture of real resources that are finding their way into the classroom. And this graph is fairly compelling, I think. That's about a 25% decline in funding per weighted student over this period. Even though actual dollars are going up, when you adjust for the cost increases that districts face, the real resources they have to devote to students has declined fairly dramatically.
Mr. Chair.
And what that shows is the effects of the property tax limitation measures, starting with 5, but especially 5047.
And Mr. Reeder, if you could provide the committee, I know it's always a risk to hand all of us what our ADMW looks like for each one of our schools, but I think it's important with the amount of new people that are sitting around this dais to have that run of what that looks like for all of us, and it explains a tremendous amount when to our first discussion about why certain districts are sharing different numbers. And you have to take a deep breath, and I'm not going to talk about, you know, maybe having some spirits before you look at it, but Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To really understand, though, you need to have both the ADM, the weighted and the non-weighted.
Right.
Because you then get to see how districts and the formula interact with the amount of resources they get, because there are a few districts The last time I looked, I think Sherwood was one of the ones that had the least number of extra weights.
Yeah, they've been at the bottom for about 20 years.
Right, yeah. So they're just basically getting what you get for average students. And then other districts have the weighting effect makes a big difference for their state. So it's nice to look at the two of them personally. So.
Yeah, and Deputy Superintendent, could you comment how you survived Sherwood? Every time I saw him, all he did was say, Betty, can't you give me some of your money?
Yeah.
Co-Chair Comp, I often am reminded of some of my thoughts about when I was in Sherwood and we had very few weights by several of the lobbyists in the building. And, the formula really works hard to try to get dollars where they're needed.
Representative Taylor, I was going to call you Senator.
That's okay. Thank you, Co-Chair Comp. So regarding the weights, I just want to clarify. So, for example, regarding the students that the special ed dollars, although they get a full weight, that does not cover the cost necessarily. The weight is just the premise, the starting point of what that amount is when the formula starting out, that it's one, you get a full one per student, is really just dividing up however many students there are based on the pie, and then getting the other weight for the special ed is again just doing that calculation over again, but it is not covering the actual cost necessarily of providing special education for the district. Is that a correct statement?
Co-Chair Comp, Representative Taylor, I think it in general it is. Just as an example, if a weight pays $7,500, then a special education student would bring in $15,000 for their district. So the question is that enough to serve that student? Some students, it varies tremendously.
Right.
So we have another program, and we'll talk about that in a later slide, where for districts that have students that are very high cost, over $30,000, there's a separate fund that reimburses them for those expenses above $30,000.
Okay. Thank you.
I will answer that.
Yes, Senator.
Real
Rowland.
Quickly, which, as you just heard, they get $15,000. They get reimbursed for everything over $30,000. So
there's the gap. I got that.
There is a little bit of a gap sometimes, and depending on how many of those students you have, it can be considerable.
Okay, there are, even though most of the weights in the formula are based on student characteristics, there are a couple of cases where there are weights granted to school districts that are based on school and district characteristics, and the ones that have the most impact for individual districts are what we call the small school corrections, and there's separate calculations for elementary schools and for high schools, elementary going all the way through eighth grade, and it's designed to give additional weights and therefore additional money to districts that have very small schools. And the logic is that very small schools can't take advantage of economies of scale, so they are much more expensive to run per student than larger, more optimally sized schools. So we give out extra weights based on a formula. As the schools get larger, they get less and fewer and fewer additional weights till they're phased out. So I've got some graphs a little later that will show you some of the effects of that around the state. And then we've got in a couple districts, we still have districts that are only high school districts and districts that are only elementary districts. And not coincidentally, the elementary-only districts feed their students into the high school-only district, which actually is fairly contiguous boundaries. But we do adjust their funding because they serve only elementary or only high school students. And the logic is the cost structures of running a high school are different than running an elementary school. So we give an extra 0.2 weight to the high school-only districts, and we reduce the weight from 1 to 0.9, and these are not student weights, these are district level weights. For elementary districts, the logic being they're less expensive to run than high schools.
Okay, and Representative Smith Warner has a question, but Brian, since you know we've got about 20 minutes, and so I don't know how many more slides you have, but you can gauge that on your own. Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to clarify, are there any limits on those weights? So say 75% of your students are ELL or special education or something. Do you get those weights on every single one of them, or is there a cap at all?
Co-Chair Comp, Representative Smith Warner, there are a couple limits. The one that gets the most discussion is the special education weight. The district is limited to a maximum of 11% of their ADMR. So if you've got, if your district has 1,000 students, 1,000 ADM, then you're limited to 110 special ed weights. So if you have more than 110 special ed students, you don't get the extra weight for those ones above 11%. It's called the 11% cap. The other limit is that no single student can get more than two extra weights, so no more than three weights total. But it's essentially impossible for any student to get three weights, so that limit isn't binding. The poverty weight is not counted on an individual student level, so that doesn't fit in. A student cannot get both a special ed weight and a pregnant and parenting weight. Those are both an extra full weight. So really the most you could do really is a special ed weight and an ESL weight, and that gets you to 2.5, not to 3. So that limit really isn't binding.
Senator Roblin, and these principals and superintendents know all the tricks about around all yes. these.
There are an exception to the 11% special ed. The 11% special ed rate does have exceptions. You can file for more than that based on your populations, and I think most districts now are doing that. So it is affecting the total rate that you get for your special ed students.
Yeah, Co-Chair Comp, Senator Roblin, I apologize for failing to mention that. We call those the 11% waivers, and districts who have special ed students that are well above the 11% cap will apply for a waiver, and it's done by formula, and in essence they'll be granted some additional weights above the 11% cap.
And Brian, I doubt that you're going to get to this subject today, but Deputy Superintendent, I want to have this committee understand how school districts are using this fifth-year program at high school level. It's an interesting subject, my friends.
Madam Co-Chair?
Yes.
And when the formula was devised, the small high school allotment was designed for poor rural small high schools, and yet some of that money goes to Riverdale, the richest district in the state. It's always troubled me.
We tend to get that on the record session.
I didn't know that was the case.
Brian, let's hit it.
Co-Chair Comp, we've got a few slides in here about some proposed changes to the weights that'll be in front of the legislature this session. At the co-chair's pleasure, we could skip those since they may get a thorough discussion
in round two
at a later date, or we could go through them quickly.
Let's just skip them for now and not don't mean any intent about whether I support or don't support, but let's just skip them for now.
And what I'll just say about them is that what we realize in our formula is that it creates a set of incentives, some of which we would regard as not productive in serving students in the best way. And an example is that a student can be in an ESL program for their entire 12 or 13 years in the K-12 system. And we have examples of that. It's not a trivial number of students. And so there's every incentive for school districts to keep students in categories that generate extra weights. And so the proposals that we will that we'll be discussing in the coming weeks are ones that provide a different set of incentives, where we provide additional resources to serve those kids, but also provide an incentive for them to be brought up to proficiency more quickly, so that the resources really are go to the students who need them most. We've been talking a lot at the department recently, and I think in the legislature too, about graduation rates. And just some information for you, here's a graph that shows the relationship between graduation rates and attendance rates. And you know, it's pretty dramatic that students who attend school on a regular basis have much higher graduation rates. And so we have a this rather compelling situation where students who to be disengaged from school and are not attending regularly are not succeeding and not making it to high school graduation. A little bit of work that the department did in the last couple years that looked at English language learners and their graduation outcomes. And what we did is we followed a cohort of students over time, and we, at the time we did this about a year and a half ago or so, we could start with students who were in the fifth grade and follow them all the way through high school graduation. We couldn't go back earlier to an earlier grade yet. As we get more data, we can do that. But what we found is if the students exited ELL status, in other words, were considered to be proficient in English, before they entered high school, their graduation rates were nearly 76%, which is higher than the statewide average. If they exited during high school, that rate was 66, almost 67%, so almost 10 percentage points lower. And if they did not exit ELL status at all, their graduation rate was just above 52%. So that relationship is rather dramatic. And if you look down at the dropout rates down on the final row, it's just the reverse. Very low dropout rates for students who exit before high school, and much higher, nearly 30%. For those who don't exit at all. And this is some of the evidence that got us thinking really seriously about how to, what kind of programs can we put in place to try to get kids proficient much sooner, so that when they get to high school, they actually have a chance to succeed there and graduate at rates. And I mean, when I showed this to people, they were quite surprised at how high that high school graduation rate was among a student population that typically doesn't perform that well. Well, what this tells us is if they can become proficient in English soon enough, they hit it out of the park.
Senator Rogan.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Do you also have a chart that would show the same thing and the number of double-weighted kids, or one and a half, so ELL and special needs children? Because I think that would be informative as well.
Yeah, Co-Chair Comp, Senator Roblin, we don't have that right now, but we've been working on that issue, and we have the data that allows us to do that, so we certainly can make that available.
That would be great, thanks.
Well, and Mr. Reeder, I did advocate that you might need some more support in your department to the deputy superintendent, so he's still laughing at me.
Okay, a little bit about career and technical education, some proposals for additional weights there. And actually an issue that has been discussed more and more as we get closer to the 15-16 school year, where full day kindergarten is required. We looked at the actual costs of school districts shifting from a half-day program to a full-day program. And we did this using the quality education model because it has built into it sort of the costs of adding teachers and the costs of adding different other kinds of inputs and so forth. And you can see the way we did it is we added teachers. We always include professional development for those teachers when we add them for an analysis like this. And we added some additional specialist teachers and some aides, I believe, if I'm seeing them there.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Oh, down at the bottom.
Down at the bottom.
And so the estimate for 15-17 is about $220 million. That's, if you've been hearing that number out there, that's where this came from, is an analysis that we did at the department looking at that question.
Senator Roblin?
Thank you. That doesn't take into account new facilities necessary in some schools and not in others, correct?
Co-Chair Comp Senator Robom, that's correct. We took a stab at the capital side, but it's really hard to know because even though a lot of districts in Oregon are losing enrollment, that doesn't necessarily mean they have space to add. You know, they sometimes close schools and don't want to reopen them. So it's a hard problem to get your hands around.
Yes, please, Senator.
And that also does not include desks and materials, or does it?
Co-Chair Comp Senator Roblin, it would include all supplies. It wouldn't include things like desks, which are sort of quasi-capital. So a couple more mechanical points about the formula. We calculate ADMW, or average daily membership weighted, for the current year and the prior year, and school districts are funded on the higher of those two. The logic there is that for districts that are losing enrollment over time, that their costs aren't really declining as fast as their enrollment is, and so we give them a one-year grace period and slightly more money because of that. And the formula also gives additional money, $25 per weighted student, to the extent that a district's teacher experience is above the statewide average. For each year that it's above the average, an extra $25 per weighted student. For each year below the average, they are deducted $25 per weighted student. And we'll see a little bit about that in a couple of graphs that we got.
Well, and I just have to add this comment from my recent research and a trip to China. They start their teachers out in China at $45,000 a year, beginning teachers.
Yeah, just a comment on the same thing.
We're not on that page.
On the comment on that one, it's the understanding and the weighted formula, and other people are talking about it. I'll wait till they. I was just going to say that $25. If you realize that what was said earlier, 85% of your costs at a school district have to do with salary, and you recognize the older the teacher, the more they're going to get paid. This was a way in the formula to make a difference for that, a partial difference for the fact that if you have teachers that are for a long time, your 85% is going to be largely dependent on all your staff that are in your school district. And therefore, those that have the oldest staff are going to have the highest cost. That was the, I think, general conversation when that formula, the $25, was put in.
So this graph.
Brian, you got 5 minutes.
Okay.
You're doing awesome.
This graph shows a couple really important things. The first is this is the formula revenue per student that each district gets. So these are, each bar here is an individual school district in the state, and then you can pick out your own. We left those labels off.
And Madam Co-Chair.
We left those labels off. Senator Monroe.
And those over on the right that are all property tax are the districts that Senator Roblin was talking about. There's a handful of them that actually get no state dollars because the property taxes drive revenue that gets them above the formula without it.
Representative Springer?
Correct me if I'm wrong, Brian. Those are primarily smaller districts, aren't they, in rural areas? They're not the big districts that we sometimes talk about funding the rest of the state.
Yeah. Representative Springer, yeah, those are districts. There's two categories, one that are very small and get a lot of state timber money. So Nestucca Valley, Jewell, Mm-hmm. And the other category are ones that have a lot of taxable property per student. And examples there are like Seaside and Neocony. They have a lot of property value because they have, because of their tourist economies and their second homes, and they don't have a lot of students because the permanent populations are relatively small in both those places relative to the amount of taxable property they have. So they have a lot of local revenue per student, and they actually have more than the formula would give them, so they don't get any state money. We also don't take back the excess, so they get to keep all of that. Some states do that.
Yep.
Well, and because you can tell on this chart, there's a lot of consistencies, and every once in a while you see a dip or something that goes high, and that's why I'm asking for a run on what you can, you know, a paper copy of, or electronic copy of what these figures mean for each district.
And what this graph points out is that every district gets roughly the same amount mm-hmm. per weighted student. And the gray part is their local revenue, and the red part is their state revenue. And so if they have really low local revenue, they get a lot of state revenue to bring them up to that level, and vice versa. And the small differences that you see there where some are higher than others, that is solely caused by the teacher experience factor. So okay. That third bar over that's well above 7,000, that's a district that has lots of high experienced teachers, and the ones that dip down are the ones that have a lot of low experienced teachers.
Thank you. Senator Roblin?
Yeah, I'm looking at the first one. So is that the School of the Deaf? I mean, I can't think of any other school that would have no property tax.
If you look really closely.
Oh, there is some.
And I don't know. These are just the 197
right.
school districts. I don't know who that is, but when I generate the table
okay.
for you, you'll be
That's
able
amazing.
To see that. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Okay.
Let's go to the next page and finish up, Brian.
Okay, and so this is just a different look. The last one was funding per weighted student, but then if you look at that same graph, but per actual student, then you see differences because some districts have proportionally more weights than others. And the part that's really interesting to me is you can see that arrow over there. Up until that point, all the districts are pretty close to each other mm-hmm. because none of them get the extra weights, because the small school correction weights, mm-hmm. the extra weights for being small. All the ones to the right of that arrow get extra weights because they're small. And you go all the way to the right-hand side, and that is a district, and again, I don't know who it is, but that's a district that's got two or three students.
Yeah.
And they get a massive amount of money per student from that small school correction. Now, people often react to that. You know, 70,000, 65,000 per student.
Yeah, I've been reacting to it for 10 years. Yes.
But in the overall scheme of things, and the text in that box tells you that it's 2.6% of the students in the state are in those districts, and they receive 3.6% of all the formula funding. So it's a fair number of districts, and the dollars per student can get quite high. But in the overall scheme of things, it's really, really small.
Yep.
Okay. I thank you for your presentation this morning, Brian. I don't know how many more pages you have, but can we see you on Monday?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think we're getting close to the end here.
Okay. And Superintendent Saxton, words to the wise. What you learned today?
Co-chairs, compliment room, members of the committee. I'm always, it's always interesting because I think I know this stuff forwards and backward, and then we start talking about it, and I'm always reminded of little exceptions or little pieces of things. And the truth of the matter is that this formula was put together back when Ballot
1895
was passed
yeah.
in order to try to figure out how to do this, and then it's as real or perceived problems have cropped up over time, there have been changes in the formula to try to accommodate for those issues, and it creates a number of the rules and things that you've been hearing about here today, small school correction, for example, or changes in how we distribute the state the transportation formula at various rates and so forth are things that have just changed over time. We continue to look at identifying those issues and see if we can use dollars as wisely as possible so that all students have an equal opportunity to access a high-quality education in the state.
Thank you. And I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5016 and House Bill 5017. And committee, thank you for your time this week. It's been an informative week, but hard work. Thank you. We're adjourned. We're adjourned.